Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. Scholarly Communication is an open and ongoing conversation about how communication does knowledge. The premise of the podcast is this: communicating is not a transferring, as if knowledge might be vacuum sealed and delivered totally conserved, brain to brain. No, the premise of the podcast is that research communication is a place and time where people meet to represent and to recreate the things they claim to know. Communication is meaning, as knowledge is too. And meaning is not something that we send or receive, it's something that we make. I'm your host, Daniel Shea. I invite you to listen to authors of papers and editors at journals, and also people who have studied or are studying scholarly communication, all of them discussing just how it is that the published word makes known the researched world. My guest today is Lee McIntyre, research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science, Boston University, and senior advisor for public trust in science, Aspen Institute. Lee is also a recent lecturer in ethics at the Harvard Extension School, the author of multiple books, including Dark Ages, The Case for a Science of Human Behavior, 2006, and Post-Truth, 2018. Lee has a firm interest in questions of philosophy of science and as well in science communication. For our discussion today, we'll be taking his 2019 book as our basis, that is, The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience, published by MIT Press. So let's begin today's episode. Lee McIntyre on Scholarly Communication. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Your book really impressed me as coming up with a solution that it's one of those solutions that in hindsight seems quite obvious, but therefore all the harder to arrive at. And that is, there's a sort of aporia that's been reached in the philosophy of science as to, well, how do we tell when we have science on our hands, right? Or is it something else? And you turn to the people who are doing it, the scientists themselves, and have postulated there a particular approach to the world, a particular way of thinking, as you call it, an attitude. How, let's say, confident are you in the fact that you've hit upon something that's actually going to now advance our thinking and philosophy of science?
Well, I love that question, and of course, but I also think of my goal as not just to advance our thinking and philosophy of science, though that's what I do. And, you know, I'm a philosopher of science, and it would make me very happy to make a contribution to this debate that has, you know, bedeviled philosophy of science ever since it started about 100 years ago, which is what's so special about science. Well, that got telescoped into the demarcation debate, and we've been yelling at one another for all these years. But to me, the more important thing is to capture not just, you know, what the philosophers think is special about science, but the scientists, because the scientists, for the most part, don't really study philosophy of science. Sometimes they have an avocational interest. Sometimes they say rude things about the philosophy of science. I mean, I remember Richard Feynman saying that philosophers were as useful to scientists as ornithologists were to birds. So, you know, and there are there are even worse quotations out there. But I mean, it's according to scientists, these philosophical debates don't really push things forward. We can't nail down what's special about science, but they're out there doing it. And so I wanted to think really hard about how that could be. I mean, if what was really special about science was its method or its logic, then you would think that in graduate school, you know, in their training, scientists would have to study the logic and methodology of science. But from what I understand, they really don't. They study the content of whatever discipline they're in. But having gone to graduate school myself in philosophy, I know that at least part of graduate training is when you learn the cultural values, the ethos, the attitudes that you're supposed to have when you're joining the profession. And one of those is something that I call the scientific attitude, which is that evidence is paramount, that you care about evidence and that you're willing to change your mind on the basis of new evidence. And that, to me, seemed to be the nub of it. It seems to not only address the philosopher's concern that they've been trying to, you know, solve through logic and method all these years, you know, to make it something out of deductive logic if they can, and really to move the ball forward and say something that the scientists would approve of as well. Because I think, I mean, as most philosophers of science think, scientists are my heroes. Scientists are the ones who are doing this amazing work. And I wanted to see if I could solve this problem to protect their work when it's now under attack. I mean, science is under assault now in the last 10, 15, 20 years. Like it's, well, I say like it's never been before. It certainly wasn't Galileo's time and before. But in the modern era, science is once again under attack. And I wanted to know what I could do to defend science and to explain why fraud is so terrible, why it's kind of the one cardinal sin in science, and how we can grow science elsewhere. And I think that's all really captured in, you know, what I'm after in this book.
And that very much answers my question, because, I mean, you're talking about advances and new ideas, not only in the philosophy of science, but actually quite more so outside of the philosophy of science as well. I mean, you want to help the public debate and bring into society a greater appreciation for something that's going to actually serve us. You also are interested in the scientists themselves, which is why the turn toward the scientific attitude I find is so consistent then with your approach, because here we have a recognition of the fact that science, as any other pursuit or any other profession, has its own culture. As you said, yes. The culture that comes about through the training that people go through in science, even if it's not explicit training in, say, language and culture, still is indoctrination is a bad word, enculturation of people who are doing this important work. And I think that that's really one of those key turns away from hard logic, which is almost sometimes being in the demarcation debate, a sort of symbolic logic, over into, well, what is it that you do when you're a scientist?
It is. And, you know, in graduate school, we're one thing in philosophy of science that, you know, you're taught from the very beginning is that there's the logic of discovery and then there's the logic of justification, and that we really don't need to pay too much attention to how scientists discover, you know, what their theories are, but we need to pay a lot of attention to how they're justified, because, you know, we want to be able to logically defend them. I think that most philosophers of science see themselves as, you know, wanting to be helpful to the defense of science. But I think, you know, in my mind, it always seemed a little odd that we weren't supposed to be that interested, you know, except kind of avocationally, or to use an example, you know, from Kekulé or, you know, something like that, for how science worked. Because when you're trying to justify science by a means other than you know, the process that scientists are using, it always seemed a little, you know, cart before the horse. But I've been fascinated in my career with how scientists think, because scientists to me seem to have this great flexibility of mind that I wish we had elsewhere. You know, this is something that I wish not only that we could expand the number of people who do science, but the scientific attitude, because the ability to say, you know, I think that X is true, but if you could show me this evidence that it wasn't true, I would change my mind. Or to say, here's what you would have to show me to change my mind. I just think that is the height of the Enlightenment ideal. That's the height of flexibility of mind and just the idea that, you know, you really are letting the evidence guide you. And so it allows you the flexibility to lean into all these things that philosophers have been allergic to, like values. You know, there's, well, we've got the fact value distinction. Let's not talk about values. You know, let's not talk about the logic of discovery. Let's talk about logic because we're comfortable with that. But I think you really do have to look, if you want to defend science, at the kinds of virtues, the kinds of values that scientists bring to the table, because it explains the ability of scientists to say, you know what, my theory is one that I really wanted to believe was true. I based my entire career on it, but this young Turk came along, showed me where I was wrong, and I changed my mind. I mean, that's even noble, I would say. And you don't find that. You'd simply not, let alone in politics or, you know, elsewhere. Where else do you find that in such a stunning example as in the history of science, of people saying, I didn't want to believe this, but the evidence compelled me, so I changed my mind. Now, there's certainly examples of times when even scientists have dragged their feet, you know, these famous instances. But the wonderful thing is that the way science works, eventually it does close in on the idea that no, the evidence is what counts, and we move on. And I have to say that, you know, this idea has been percolating in the philosophy of science for a long time. I didn't just make this up de novo. I mean, it was there in proto form in Karl Popper. I learned from Thomas Kuhn, you know, other folks, Helen Longino. And this idea has been there, but it was some labor to really bring it to the fore and say, no, don't you realize that this is precisely what we need? Let's stop trying to solve the formal demarcation problem, and let's instead realize that this is the answer that will allow us to defend science and to move science forward and to lean into why we shouldn't be embarrassed by scientific uncertainty, why we shouldn't be embarrassed by scientists changing their mind. That's a superpower of science. That's not something to be embarrassed by.
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, when you get into the public arena, just that point becomes crucial to make it clear as to how that's actually a kind of virtue, this uncertainty, a willingness to live in uncertainties. But what you say there about why the scientific attitude, why it's worth staking so much on the scientific attitude when it comes to sort of explanatory power, really draws my attention back to this idea of culture. I mean, you talked about, you know, let's take the values as opposed to just the facts. Let's take the discovery as opposed to just the hard symbolic logic. And it made me think also, as you were there praising this idea of, right, through evidence, I will accept your side to the argument because you've convinced me. The community as across from the individual, or even if you like the romantic idea of the genius. Mm. Because if you go into the humanities, you're more likely to meet that. You're more likely to meet the idea that you should understand me. Whereas the scientist is, I should make myself understood to you.
I love that way of thinking about it because it really, it's, some people have misunderstood what I've said about the scientific attitude as if, and again, this is the reflex that philosophers have, you know, to ask, oh, does that mean that every scientist has to have the scientific attitude? Well, they should, but what it is really an ethos in the profession, which, like any other ethos, different people have to different degrees. So, you know, some have it more than others. Some people maybe don't have it at all. If they cheat, if they commit fraud, then they're ultimately read out of the profession. It's sometimes said there are no heretics in science. Well, maybe that's true in terms of proposing an outlandish idea. It's not an ideology. We can propose anything we want, but then let's test it. But somebody who then fakes the data, or who isn't willing to test their pet theory, or who defends it even after it's been disproven, that person gets read out of the profession. Why? Because they violated the central norm, is that we need to be guided by the evidence. And that's something that I think a lot of people have missed. If you look at early philosophy of science, if you look at even some contemporary philosophy of science, they're so hung up on the idea of method and logic that it's easy for the lay public to, well, even for scientists to dismiss what philosophers do. But worse, I think that the lay public, they don't really come to appreciate what's most central about science. I'll give you an example. I think that most people out there believe that there's something called the scientific method, as if there's some recipe that can just, you know, you put in facts at one end and you get truth at the other. That's an enormous misunderstanding. I mean, Popper thought that. A lot of philosophers think that. I think I said it at one point in the book, you know, if there's one thing that the public thinks is that what's special about science is the scientific method. If there's one thing that unites all philosophers of science, it's that there's no scientific method. So you know, I didn't make that up. But, you know, the real problem with public understanding of science is that they think that science is about proof and certainty, but it's not. And every scientist knows this. But if you look at a science denier, or you look at somebody who's anti-science, which there aren't many of them, but there are some, they'll say, well, can you prove this? Are you certain of it? And the scientist is usually will say, well, no, it can't be proven, but we've got, you know, such and such confidence interval, or, you know, this is the probability that it's true, which leads the uninitiated to say, oh, well, then my theory still might be true. Well, yes, but that, you know, they've never read Hume. They don't know anything about the problem of induction or the history of philosophy. And so go on their way thinking that, well, it's all equal and we'll just wait for proof. Meantime, climate change, the idea about COVID vaccines being, you know, maybe a good thing during a pandemic, you know, these can get dismissed by people who misunderstand it, by charlatans who are making money, by the general public, because they don't understand that science is not about proof. Science is about warrant. What we're after is, in science, is the ability to say, this theory is stronger than the other theory because it's a better fit with the evidence. That doesn't necessarily mean that I can prove it or that it's true, but it means that I'm more justified in believing it than its alternative. And I'm a fallibilist. It means that if there's evidence in the future that you can provide that shows me that I should change my mind, I will do that. That is not a weakness. And if the public understood that, I think we would be, and if scientists weren't embarrassed by that, I think that we would be on firmer ground in our science communications.
In the brand of linguistics that I use in my work, as my listeners will know, I help scientists write functionalism or functional linguistics. There is basically the idea that all the time that we're speaking or writing, we're doing at least two things. There's an interpersonal component to what's going on, and then there's an ideational or experiential component to what's going on. And I think what you've just laid out for us there from a public viewpoint, also the history of science viewpoint, and perhaps even we can explore this from the scientist's own viewpoint, although as soon as they get a bit of experience at publishing, I think that goes away quickly, that this experiential, ideational meaning gets put as the apex of scientific thinking, right? So logic, right? Putting coherent thought together, drawing up arguments that are waterproof and foolproof and so on. However, what you're doing with the attitude and what I see in my own brand of linguistics is this overlaying of interest, this bringing in of the interpersonal level of communication, this recognition of a community that we're all only through our common interests and our common checking of one another, our intersubjective objectivity, if you like, even, are we able to create something that's called a warrant? Are we able to find justification through our common efforts to check one another and even check ourselves? So yes. I suppose to just sort of bring it to a point, what I'm saying is that, yes, we have logic and argumentation underneath a sort of shell or a sort of outer layer of what makes the community and its values actually a thing in the first place.
I think that's right. Think about scientific disputes. When there's a scientific dispute, you know, which Kuhn talks about, I mean, this happens, right? This is what makes science. What settles those disputes ultimately is evidence. Now, evidence within the context of argument and, you know, theory and testing and, you know, all, and sometimes evidence is so hard to come by and it, you know, can take decades to turn up. The interesting thing that happens is, I think you've mentioned community a couple of times, and I think that's important, that the scientific attitude is a community ethos. If somebody said, well, you know, no, that's not how science works, because here I've turned up an example of this scientist that didn't have the scientific attitude, or even this period of time when most scientists rejected this theory that came out to be right. That's not correct. That's not a counterexample to my theory. My idea is that this is a community norm that scientists just imbibe when they're in graduate school, with probably where they first learned it, or undergraduate, wherever, when it just, you understand that you're going to be checked and you need to check other people's work, because if it's wrong, you don't want to build on it. And so that, I think, makes scientists unusually honest as human beings go. For one thing, I mean, I joke sometimes that the scientific attitude is what keeps scientists honest, even if they were honest in the first place. Because if you know that one of your colleagues is going to be very hot to critique your work, then you're not very anxious to put some speculation out there that's not backed up by evidence, right? You want to have that thing waterproof before it gets published. And I mean, that's what peer review and that sort of thing is all about. And so I think it does help scientists to keep themselves honest. But the really important thing is that it makes the profession more honest. It means that honesty, transparency, the ability to subject your ideas to critical scrutiny, that is a community norm in science. And, you know, but now when you say community, you immediately have to qualify by saying, well, which community are you talking about? Because scientists are taught that the community that they're, for the most part, communicating with are one another. If you're trying to convince a scientist that you're right, it's necessary and sufficient to give them the evidence. But if you're trying to convince the lay public that you're right, you have to be a little more ginger about it, because there's this delicate issue of trust. And trust can get undermined by fraudsters and charlatans and, you know, people who share disinformation and deniers who, you know, are out there telling you, oh, look, no, that scientist, you know, changed his mind, like Dr. Fauci on masks. Oh, so he must have been a liar. And then once trust is broken, it's broken. Now, if you're a scientist and you're speaking within the science community, everybody understands, well, of course he changed his mind. What would you have him do? The evidence changed. But to the community that doesn't understand that norm, That sounds like lying. And so, you know, I often say that science deniers don't have a fact deficit. They have a trust deficit. So if a scientist goes into a conversation with a member of the public, not understanding that, maybe they're using what's called the information deficit model, right? Oh, you want to know why you should believe that climate change is real? Here's the evidence. And then the person says, well, I don't believe your data. I think you're a liar. I think you're paid off, you know, by George Soros or something. And the scientist, well, what do you do at that point? You walk away because, I mean, this is an irrational person. They don't understand. I've given them the evidence, but they didn't accept it. I'm going to walk away. That's not a successful encounter with the public. That would be a rational response if you were communicating with a scientific colleague. But in science communication with the public, there are further steps required.
And I like this idea. Yes, I mean, to begin with, I totally agree. Yes, I mean, you're dealing with different norms and a different ethos if you move in or outside of the scientific community. But to stay inside of the scientific community, which is the particular interest of this podcast, I mean, this idea of a community ethos, I think that's wonderful. And I think I would go so far as to say sub-communal ethoses, mm-hmm. because at that point, once you move from biology to computer science or into, let's say, environmental science or something like that, you move across such vast spaces that you do have to, of course, you have the same basic attitude of trust in evidence and understanding whether or not the name is used, of negotiation, mm-hmm. as to what is a better argument or not, since there's no surety. Right. So, I mean, the warrants, as they're more technically called. But you are still crossing very large divides. I mean, I've worked with, to just take the two examples, biologists and computer scientists. And I felt very, and I feel very much like I've moved in different worlds entirely and have even heard yes. from one side or the other disparaging remarks, which are almost akin to the kind of things that you would get from, you know, a lay public that just wasn't yes. quite as up on the way that scientific thinking goes.
Yeah. And it is, and this is what makes it so fascinating, I think, to study as historians of science do, or sociologists of science, how these disputes get settled, or even philosophers of science, because it's messy. And it's messier in some fields than others. But, you know, there are all of these outstanding questions about, well, what counts as evidence? How much evidence do you need? You know, how even if you think that you have evidence, how should you reason on its basis? I mean, there's a furious dispute within probability theory about Bayes' theorem, you know, about how you should reason on the basis of evidence. You know, Deborah Mayo is a leader here in saying, you know, no, there's more than one way to reason on the basis of evidence. So, I mean, there are all of these, I mean, are these doctrinal disputes? Are these ideological disputes? Or are those also disputes that can be settled by evidence? I mean, in some cases, what counts as evidence? You know, what decides it? I mean, this is why I get so excited, you know, by, as a philosopher, when, you know, I get the question. So I've said, you know, well, the scientific attitude is when you're willing to change your mind on the basis of new evidence. And then you get the question, well, what counts as evidence? What do you mean by evidence? What would be sufficient evidence? Here, I mean, I was just, I don't know which book this comes from. I saw a picture of a page from a scientific textbook on a friend's social media account. He's a science teacher. Maybe you can tell me where this comes from. Maybe someone can write me an email and tell me where this comes from, because I think this is just marvelous. It's chapter 7, the chapter title, Direct Experimental Evidence for String Theory. And there is one sentence in that chapter. It says, there is no direct experimental evidence for string theory. Now, gorgeous. So, you know, so if you talk to philosophers they will say, or scientists, I mean, you know, rational people, they will sometimes say, well, but it's irrational to believe something on the basis of no evidence. This is how you get flat earthers. This is how you get, you know, all these other folks. And yet, I think it is true that there's no direct experimental evidence for string theory. I mean, here it is in chapter 7 of this book that I don't know which book it is. It's on page 107. And yet, that's a leading, the leading theory in particle physics. So how does this, dispute get settled? I mean, so it is not a trivial question. What counts as evidence, and what you do in this day and age when evidence can be really hard to come by, and we have all of these sorts of interdisciplinary disputes, or even intradisciplinary disputes. This is marvelous stuff.
Yeah, most certainly. And it again brings us back to the importance of culture, which is where we sort of kicked things off. Because I do believe that you have certainly put your finger on something very important about talking about a scientific attitude, because I do also entirely expect that the string theorist all the way over to the evolutionary biologist would at some future point always understand each other. Yes. And yet we've got the muddle of every day, and we've got the different stages of experimental possibilities. We've got the different amassment of evidence for or against one or the other theory. And crucially, I think we've got the different way of being interested in something. You know, the computer scientist who is trying to, let's say, understand software systems is going to be thinking initially about a framework, right? About what is, let's say, the theoretical before I even bring in ideas of application or experimentation. Whereas very many biologists are going to be turning directly to the object of inquiry. You know, the theory is in many cases assumed in a way. And that doesn't mean that they're doing anything fundamentally different, but they're doing it in different ways.
Well, yes. And I mean, you could even enlarge the picture, as I argued in my book, Dark Ages, we should, to include the social sciences. Because one of my long-term goals in articulating what's special about science is so that we can grow it elsewhere. And the social sciences have had a hell of a hard time emulating what goes on in science if they don't understand that what's essential about it is reasoning on the basis of evidence. Because, you know, then, I mean, and it's easy mud to sling to say that, well, then the social scientists, in the social sciences, it's all subjective. They're not really sciences. Yet there are a number of, you know, folks in the social sciences that take the, you know, obviously take umbrage at that. No, they're doing science. But is it different when you've got a subject matter that can talk and can reason and can defy your prediction about it? A wonderful essay by Fritz Machlup back in the 50s, If Matter Could Talk, you know? I mean, we're beings that understand the predictions made about us. So does that change our behavior? And what does that say for the scientific study of human behavior? I mean, this is all a very, you know, these methodological questions are all really fascinating to me. The thing that I think unites, or let me put it this way, the thing that should unite physics, sociology, biology, is the spirit that, and I can't remember the name of the scientist. I probably knew this yesterday and the day before, but the name escapes me now. The famous evolutionary biologist, that when they asked him, well, what could convince you to give up evolution, the theory of evolution by natural selection? And he said, rabbit fossils in the Precambrian era. That is pretty damned specific. I mean, you don't, that, and I'll tell you this, because I've spent the last 10 years studying science deniers. They cannot answer that question. If you go up to a flat earther or an anti-vaxxer or a climate denier, and you say, well, you're just not doing science, they say, oh, no, I'm doing science. I'm more scientific than the scientists. They're not taking me seriously. They won't look at my evidence. And, you know, they're corrupt. They're this, they're that, you know, but they don't have any, because they've been subjected to all this disinformation. They don't trust scientists. Okay. So, but then if I say to them, you know, or they'll say the scientists haven't proven their theory, I'll say, well, you, but as a scientist yourself, you know, but they're not, do you understand that science is not about proof, it's about evidence? Well, you know, we can get off on a dog leg about that, but the atom bomb question that I'm holding in my back pocket is Popper's question. Karl Popper, one of my great heroes in the philosophy of science, who asked this question: what evidence would convince you to change your mind? That is the question that cleaves science deniers from actual scientists. Because an actual scientist will say, if you showed me X, I would change my mind. And a science denier cannot answer that question. So that quotation I just read you from about string theory, there may be no direct experimental evidence, you know, right now in favor of string theory. And people smile when they read that, ha ha. Well, those data are very, very, very difficult to come by. You know, what you have to do to get the direct experimental evidence. I mean, it's not that there couldn't be, it's just that they don't have it yet. But the theory makes sense for various reasons, et cetera. And they dispute about that. But does that mean that string theorists are not scientific? No, because if you said to a string theorist, what would convince you to give up string theory? I'm convinced they could tell you. They could say, you know, and I'm not well schooled enough in the area to know what they would say, but they would say whatever the particle physics equivalent is of rabbits in the Precambrian era. That's the difference.
Yeah, most certainly. Is it possible Edward Wilson is the evolutionary biologist?
I do not think so. I think it was Dobzhansky or that's where I read it. I don't know. Somebody will listen to this and be out of their chair in 2 seconds to send me an email correcting me, and that's fine because I really want to know this. And there's always the let me Google that for you. I could probably find that out right now, and you'd hear all the clicking, but that's cheating. And I don't remember who it was, but the brilliant. I think the brilliant demonstration of the scientific attitude.
There. Most certainly. I mean, that's the real point. I thought I had it, so I just took a stab, but yes.
was not Wilson. No.
That's the idea though. Yeah, for sure. And maybe just to close out, Lee, one thing that I would almost like to bring us full circle, because you had talked about at the beginning how there's a bit of a negative attitude from the scientific community over into the philosophy of science. Like, what exactly are we learning then from all of that and so on? And yet I actually think there is quite a lot that can be learned from there. I mean, if I read works like yours, which just put front and center this idea of a culture inside of science and the importance of that culture for the advancement of knowledge, or the increase in certainty, not pure certainty ever, but the increase in certainty about certain ideas and so on, being based upon a level of justified interest, a level of warrant, all these things which really go beyond logic and into a communal spirit, a communal attitude, a way of approaching things, something that you accept to become a member, right? Then what I notice is that there is room here for training of scientists. They are clearly picking these things up because they're observable and people like you are able to codify them for us, but they're picking them up in such a sort of implicit manner that they're perhaps not able to use them also to their advantage. I think particularly in the area of communication.
Yes.
I mean, this is just one example. I'm sure you can think of others where, you know, early career researchers very often spend a long time misunderstanding the goal of what they're trying to do when they're writing a paper, thinking that it's about, you know, making facts entirely understandable, putting them into solid argumentation, it's not that that's not the case, but there's more going on than that. And it's only through experience that very many of them gain that. But if they had the training in a scientific attitude, I think they would come quicker to the realization of what it is they're about there.
I think it will cheer scientists up to think, yes, someone understands that, you know, our value, respects what we do and understands that, you know, the values that, you know, we're actually embodying here. But there is a training deficit, which is that scientists, for the most part, to my knowledge, are not even today trained in graduate school how best to communicate their results so that they will be understood and believed. I mean, we no longer live in an era of automatic trust for authority figures, and public trust in science is higher than it is for, you know, politicians and bankers and, you know, cab drivers and others. I mean, Pew Research has done some work on this. And so, I mean, you can look at that and say, oh, but science is still pretty good, relatively speaking. But trust in science has fallen, especially on partisan grounds, you know, over the last decade. And if this is of concern to scientists, there are certainly ways that they can educate themselves. There are scientific studies out there. One appeared in Nature in 2019. By Cornelia Bates and Philip Schmid, which demonstrates empirically that scientists have a role in convincing science deniers to change their mind. So any scientist who's walked away from those encounters and said, these people aren't worth talking to, my counter is, well, but you're now being a science denier yourself, because there is a paper which was very well done and that everyone should read, which shows that, no, you can do this. By the way, that paper also shows that we all allies of science have a role, because what convinces people is not merely, or not even sometimes, the content of science, but questioning their reasoning capacity. Why? You know, how, not only what they believe, but why they believe it. So, you know, this is important. A scientist should read their fellow scientist, Stuart Feierstein's important book, Failure. He's got an earlier one called Ignorance, which argues that these are concepts to be embraced. This explains what's special about science. And I mean, sometimes scientists, I think, don't even know the history of their own profession. There are, and there are places for training too. There's the Alan Alda Institute at SUNY Stony Brook, where scientists and journalists and others can learn how better to communicate scientific results to the general public. The University of Cincinnati has the Center for Public Engagement with Science. I think that scientists have an enormous role, and I'll even say a responsibility, to make sure that they're not just doing the work, but their work doesn't end with the discoveries. Their work also includes the communication of those discoveries, not only to their scientific colleagues, but beyond that. I think there's enormous room for more public education, not just about the results of science, but about how science actually works. In fact, I wish that were taught in school. My own elementary school education in science was science appreciation. You know, aren't we lucky to be born into the era in which all truth has been discovered? Now let's see what the genius has found. But nobody trained me in how to be a scientist. And I would very much have liked that. I didn't really discover astronomy until I got to college and started off wanting to be an astronomer and, you know, really respecting the discoveries and the values, then, you know, took this dogleg into philosophy because I was fascinated with this question of, well, what really is special about science? And, you know, got sucked into this demarcation problem between science and nonsense. What's the hard and fast thing, which every time you try to grab it, it turns into smoke? I don't think that problem can be solved. Can't be solved logically. Popper gave it a valiant try. He's brilliant. He's you know, wonderful. But the proto idea of the scientific attitude was there in his work all along, as it, you know, has been in so many others. And it's that what's really special about science is not the method or the logic. It's the It's the values, it's the virtues, it's the attitude, it's the flexibility of mind and openness to say, I could be wrong. Now let's look at what the data say. I think that is, I'll go so far as to say, I think that's human reason at its best. I think that if you look at, you know, the arc of human reason from recorded history, you know, from back from Socrates until now, I think that the ability to change your mind on the basis of empirical evidence is the pinnacle of honesty and integrity in human reason.
Well, thank you very much for that, Lee. That is Lee McIntyre, author of the book The Scientific Attitude, and thanks too to you, my listeners. Bye-bye, and until next time here on Scholarly Communication.